Welcome to The Last Month at the Federal Circuit, a look at recent Federal Circuit decisions impacting the intellectual property community. Finnegan partner Elizabeth Farrell joins us now to offer a roundup of recent case developments impacting design patents. The first case we want to talk about is Hafco Foundry and Machine Co. versus GMS Mine Repair. Can you first just give us some background on that dispute?
So this was a design patent for a device that's used to distribute rock dust in areas such as coal mines. And GMS Mines, the accused infringer, was originally a distributor of Hafco, but their business relationship faltered and eventually GMS started producing its own rock dust blower. So Hafco filed suit and the jury found that GMS was liable for willful infringement and the court entered a permanent injunction. The court also denied GMS's judgment as a matter of law request of non-infringement, and GMS had argued that the two designs were plainly dissimilar, and as a result, that the court should enter a finding of non-infringement. Instead, the court denied that request and found that substantial evidence supported the jury's verdict of infringement. The court also denied a request for a new trial.
And the Federal Circuit's decision, what were the key holdings of that?
So to billboard the end, the Federal Circuit actually affirmed judgment of infringement and denied the request for a new trial. There were also some damages issues in the case, which I'm not going to discuss, but I think with respect to infringement, there were four key takeaways. The first one is that GMS had, well, they had many issues with the jury instructions, but in this first takeaway, the issue that they had was that they thought the jury should have been instructed that small differences between the accused design and the claim design should avoid infringement. And the Federal Circuit, first of all, said that no such instruction was requested at trial, but they went even further than that and said that, in fact, it would not have been correct for the district court to give such an instruction, reaffirming the idea that the patented and accused designs do not need to be identical in order for a design patent to be found infringed. This was a reaffirmation of the Braun case and many others, but in particular, the Federal Circuit cited to the Braun case from 1992. And the second and third key takeaways were both about the ordinary observer. So for design patent infringement, the test is from the perspective of the ordinary observer. And the second key takeaway was about who that ordinary observer is. The instruction that was given to the jury was an ordinary observer is a person who buys and uses the product at issue. And the Federal Circuit said that they found no error with that particular jury instruction. Again, reaffirming this idea that the ordinary observer is the purchaser of the product accused of infringement, which can actually be very meaningful in cases where you're trying to understand whether the product accused of infringement is purchased by perhaps a standard consumer versus an industrial buyer. The third key takeaway was a consideration of how the ordinary observer views the article when making his or her assessment of infringement. And the instruction in this case was related to whether the ordinary observer would view the article as a whole. And again, the Federal Circuit said that yes, the article should be viewed as a whole, meaning that you're not breaking the article down into individual pieces and parts, but you're instead considering the overall visual impression. And the Federal Circuit cited the Ethicon case from 2015 for this proposition. But I think an important point to note in this case is that the Federal Circuit made it very clear that when evaluating designs, and the Federal Circuit said, be it the claim design, the one in the patent, the accused design, you know, design that's accused of infringement, or prior art designs, the focus should always be on the overall appearance of the design and not the individual features. And then the final fourth takeaway was the Federal Circuit's continued emphasis on the importance of prior art in the design patent infringement evaluation. In this case, well, we know from Egyptian Goddess that the burden is on the accused infringer to produce relevant prior art. And in this case, GMS did not produce any such art. But GMS nonetheless on appeal said that it was error to not provide a jury instruction about the importance of the prior art. And what the Federal Circuit said was that, yes, such a jury instruction would be important, except in this case where GMS had actually provided no prior art, it couldn't necessarily be error to exclude an instruction related to a topic like prior art which GMS had never actually produced in the first place.
Given those bottom line conclusions, what are the implications of those holdings for design patent holders?
Well, I think that this case is helpful to design patent holders as well as those that are accused of infringement, because I think the Federal Circuit has continued its practice over the last few years of tying up and tying together, let's say, cases that have come from before. You know, the Braun case, for example, came from 1992, Egyptian Goddess was from 2008, and just sort of tying together these different pieces of the design patent jurisprudence in a way that I think hopefully clarifies some of these concepts. Again, these are not things the Federal Circuit hasn't talked about before, but I think that it's helpful when the Federal Circuit gives additional examples and continues to explain these concepts. One other thing that's nice about this case is that it's in the context of jury instructions. Not a lot of design patent cases make it to trial. Well, not a lot of cases make it to trial, but not a lot of design patent cases make it to trial or even through trial to a jury verdict. And so we don't have a lot of guidance about jury instructions that are specific to design patent cases. And so this is a nice case because I think it gives us some clear indications about the Federal Circuit's thinking regarding propriety of certain jury instructions.
Well, moving on, let's discuss what the Federal Circuit didn't decide. Let's start with Columbia Sportswear North America, Inc. versus Sirius Innovative Accessories, in which the full Federal Circuit denied a petition for rehearing. The Federal Circuit's order was short, but the briefing in the case was robust. What stood out to you?
Well, let's just back up for a second and talk a little bit about what the case was about. So Columbia had a design patent that was directed to a design for a type of fabric ornamentation, and Cirrus was a competitor that was making products using a particular type of fabric that with ornamentation on it, and Columbia sued Cirrus. And in the district court actually did a summary judgment of infringement, and the Federal Circuit actually overturned that summary judgment decision on a number of different grounds, but one of them was related to the district court's determination that it was not going to consider the defendant's brand name on the accused product in the infringement analysis. So part of Cirrus's design included the Cirrus brand name. And the district court had made it clear that the court was not considering that brand name. And the court was relying on a case from 1993, which is the LA Gear case. And in the LA Gear case, among many other things, what the Federal Circuit said was that you couldn't avoid design patent infringement by labeling. And that's been a pretty solid part of the case law since then. But in the Columbia decision, the Federal Circuit perhaps muddied the water a bit and made certain characterizations about the LA Gear decision. And essentially, in comparing LA Gear to the Gorham decision from the mid-1800s, said that it would be inconsistent with Gorham to ignore elements of the accused design, such as labeling, and in this case, simply because those elements included the name of the defendant. And so the Columbia versus Sears case, you know, heads back to the district court for reconsideration of a lot of issues. But in the meantime, there was a request for the petition for rehearing en banc, and that was filed by Columbia. And what the petition for rehearing en banc essentially said was that the Federal Circuit had undermined the holding of LA Gear in the panel in Columbia had, and that in doing so, this was going to create some very serious problems moving forward. And the petition encouraged the Federal Circuit to reconsider its decision and restore LA Gear to its full breadth and reaffirm the principle that design patent infringement analysis should look at the overall appearance of the accused design, not the overall appearance of the entire product accused of infringement. And there were actually a number of amicus petitions that were filed in this case. The Industrial Designers of America, the Society of America, the IDSA, they filed an amicus petition. They said that branding should be irrelevant to the infringement analysis, and that if you added branding into the analysis, that it would distort the ordinary observer test. There was also other amici who argued that this was a dramatic departure from the longstanding precedent of the LA Gear case. in one case arguing that this would open a Pandora's box of, quote, label-based design patent non-infringement arguments. And then there was another company that filed an amicus brief that described this as an escape hatch for accused infringers. So we know in March of 2020 that the Federal Circuit denied this petition, apparently not finding that any further explanation was necessary. And I think moving forward, this is going to, I think, trickle down. And I think that it's incumbent upon those that are asserting patents to explain the strength of their design patent infringement case by addressing Columbia head on and explaining how any labeling that might be present in the accused design should not change their argument with respect to design patent infringement. And then I think that if you are an accused infringer and you do think that your labeling is something that should be taken into account, then by the same token, you may find that Columbia offers some assistance in that area.
What about Automotive Body Parts Association versus Ford Global Technologies, LLC, which, of course, the Supreme Court refused to hear? Any background on that case that you can share?
Sure. So it's not that many cases make it to the point of being a writ before the Supreme Court. So this one was one that a lot of folks paid attention to. So this is an interesting case on a lot of grounds, but what it deals primarily with is an issue related to 35 U.S.C. 171. And this is the statute that governs patentable subject matter for designs. You can think of it like the Section 101 for design patents. At the trial court level, the Automotive Body Parts Association, also known as the ABPA, actually filed a declaratory judgment action against Ford Global Technologies, arguing that certain Ford design patents claimed the aesthetic appearance of the hood and headlamp of the popular F-150 trucks, that those design patents were invalid under Section 171. ABPA also had an unenforceability argument that was related to repair and patent exhaustion doctrines. The district court soundly rejected both of those arguments and instead found that the designs were neither invalid or unenforceable. And ABPA decided to appeal this to the Federal Circuit. And in July of 2019, the Federal Circuit released its decision, also affirming the summary judgment decision of the district court. And the Federal Circuit had rejected ABP's arguments on a number of grounds, and I'll sort of briefly outline them. One was that the ABPA had tried to import certain ideas from trademark law about aesthetic functionality, and the Federal Circuit had rejected that. The Federal Circuit also rejected ABPA's arguments that the patent owner's rights were exhausted with respect to the replacement parts with the sale of the original F-150 trucks. And the Federal Circuit said that no, that exhaustion does not extend to the unlicensed third-party replacement parts because, in its mind, exhaustion only attaches to items that are sold by or with the authorization of the patentee. So in this case, the replacement parts that were being sold by ABPA's members were not parts that had ever been authorized by Ford. Therefore, Ford's rights in those design patents couldn't, with respect to the replacement parts, could not be exhausted by a sale from a third party. The court found no reason to apply a different rule for design patents. This was something that ABPA had urged the court to do in a number of different areas with respect to this appeal. And the Federal Circuit said, as they've said often in the past, that generally design patents are governed by utility patent rules unless there's something special. And in this case, there was no reason to adopt something special. And we know that the Supreme Court declined to grant cert, but I think that there's a couple of things that we can take away from this situation. I think, first of all, we know that the Federal Circuit has reaffirmed the patentability of replacement parts with design protection. This is interesting because it diverges a bit from what Europe has done in the last few years. Europe has passed what we'll call statutory laws that allow for certain types of replacement part activity. The United States has not done that, although there has been some urging in Congress to do so, but the United States has not done that. And I think we see that the Federal Circuit continues to believe that design patents can be used to protect replacement parts. And then I think the larger takeaway that's helpful to a lot of practitioners is this understanding that absent some sort of design-specific decision, that the utility rules generally apply. So if you can't find a design patent case that discusses your issue, then it's fair game to turn to the utility patent rules to look for some sort of analogous case law.
Well, that's great analysis. Thank you so much. Our guest has been Elizabeth Farrell, a partner at Finnegan, one of the largest IP law firms in the world. For more commentary on intellectual property news and issues, to listen to other podcasts, and to receive additional information on the firm, please visit www.finnegan.com. Thank you for listening to this podcast from Finnegan.